if this means accommodating ourselves to the Soviet views, not in terms of just total sellout, but settling for less than what we think would be an ideal position, if that will give momentum to the whole process at the time, then it's worth doing. And whenever he was, you know, it seemed that he just couldn't contemplate. And as time wore on and people began to become more skeptical of the talks in this country, the press started raising political questions in Congress. And Kissinger became much more defensive about it because he thought his own personal reputation was associated with the concept and the process of
God knows the whole idea started out in an atmosphere of basically favorable to it. I mean, it's something everybody wanted.
Yeah.
It wasn't that he had to overcome a lot of hostilities at that time. Yeah. He was going with the current.
Sure, right? You know, people guess at the outset, the old diehard, the old...
Yeah, Curtis LeMay's of this world.
Sure. Well, yeah, it was a concept no reasonable man could argue with. It's just when it got translated into some specifics, like the wheat deal, and the question of technology transfer, the whole basis on which our trade with Russians was going to be productive, the question of whether we should extend large credits to Russians to finance that trade, the question of whether we should get involved in these large resource exploitation deals where we made a very heavy investment at the outset to be paid off in future years as the resources were extracted. They'll build them a big pipeline at the cost of $2 billion that will give you natural gas or oil in 10 years from now, that sort of thing. And then the Jewish immigration issue, which Jackson and others brought up, to complicate the whole.
And finally, and I think maybe in the long run, most persuasively, the appalling picture of what Soviet society is like that comes through Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah. Yeah, the reminder that...
That brought me up,
That the basic character of society is one that we find pretty reprehensible.
One that makes it very questionable whether there is such a thing as détente possible, whether détente is something that they have it in their system to engage in.
Yeah. Or whether they were ever sincere about it from the very beginning, you know, this whole argument about whether they viewed it as a tactical maneuver in order to, over the short run, gain some advantages and put themselves in a better position before leaps forward a decade from now in the streets and place they're supposed to be in the Czechoslovakia.
So
anyway, on the congressional side, there was very little information flowing from Kissinger or any other source about specific U.S. positions in the negotiations or the conduct of negotiations themselves. Congress knew basically what they read in newspapers and not much more.
And that includes Jackson.
That includes Jackson, and this really is why, from before the last summit, where there was all this speculation in the press about a sellout for political reasons, to salvage Nixon, and that Jackson, who had been kept so much in the dark, felt it necessary to call everybody up to the Hill and ask them what had been going on.
By everybody, you mean the negotiators?
He called Schlesinger, he called Joe Seuss, he called Kissinger, he called Paul Nixon. Those were the witnesses. Asked them what had been going on since SALT I agreements were signed. The Congress and the relevant committees got no reports at all. He said, tell me what's been happening for the last 2 years.
This was formal hearings? I don't know.
Yeah, it was formal hearings. Mm-hmm. By the Arms Control Subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee, of which Jackson's chairman. They called him up there and he said, the committee would like to know what has been happening for the last 2 years. Read the newspapers, but we would like some communication between the executive branch and this committee on this very important issue. Yeah. And we'd like to know the history of what has transpired, where we stand now, what the current U.S. government position is, what we view the Soviet position to be, and what the government proposes doing when it goes to Moscow. Well, I don't think anybody, a reasonable person, can argue that the Congress is not entitled, at least not the whole Congress, but those charged with responsibility for overseeing this area, are entitled to this kind of information, but they just haven't been getting it.
These were closed, yeah.
Yeah, these were executive session because of the classification level of the material that they presented. And Kissinger was invited to be a lead-off witness. He couldn't make it. I forget what was going on. He was out of town, I think. So, Schlesinger went on first, then the chiefs came on. Witnesses were put under oath. And this was done primarily because the chiefs feel more comfortable when they're under oath.
And I'm like,
you know.
I understand. You don't have to explain that. I dig that.
So as not
they
to
can't
make
it, be fired for telling the truth if they're under oath.
That's right. So as not to make it too pointed, they put all of the witnesses under oath, including Kissinger. Kissinger was absolutely furious.
Being sworn.
When they asked him to take the oath, he said, I'm Secretary of State. I can't recall having been asked to take the oath before him. Jackson explained to them that all witnesses had been sworn, and so Kissinger finally accepted it. Well, anyway, Jackson felt, I think with some justification, that those hearings and the publicity that surrounded them, including this big controversy between Jackson and Kissinger on the so-called secret agreement, which I think is worth all the chapter in the book, because Zumwalt was right in the center of that from start to finish. And the story still has not been told publicly. Jackson feels that series of hearings may have been the principal reason that we did not get a bad agreement at the summit.
Did they ever publish laundered version of those hearings?
No, they haven't.
They're gone?
My understanding is they are. But they asked, Jackson asked for a lot of documentation.
Zumwalt testified.
Yeah, Zumwalt testified. Every time a pertinent document was mentioned, a NISDM or a JCS memorandum or something like that, Jackson asked to be provided to record. And this gave great problems to Kissinger.
NISDM particularly gave a problem.
Yeah, because when the whole record of documentation is put together, it doesn't paint a picture which reflects a great deal of credit on the administration.
Now, even from Newhouse, I don't agree with those. I mean, just having Newhouse fresh in my mind, I've been reading on him yesterday and the day before. Kissinger may have given him the most of the stuff, but it's by no means an apology for Kissinger, because there are times when the whole thing seemed like a damn fool whirligig, you know? Notoriously the time when... National Command Authority was offered, and then everybody said, oops, we shouldn't have done that. That story is told rather fully, and it reflects little credit on any of the people in charge.
Yeah, but what's the total impact of the story?
The total impact of the story is that no agreement would have been gotten without Kissinger, and that time will tell whether it was a good agreement or not.
Yeah.
I think that's the impact.
Yeah, and I think that is probably the best result that Kissinger could could have hoped for, and basically what he anticipated when he chartered a book like that to be written, and if the book would have any credibility at all, and if he were to get anybody responsible to do it, you know, it obviously could not be.
Do you say he chartered it on the basis of knowing that he got a hold of Newhouse and said, hey, write a book about Saul?
I don't know. You know, I don't know who made the first approach, but if you go to the record of Kissinger's confirmation hearing as Secretary of State, he was quizzed very carefully about that book. And it's all in the declassified. It was an executive session, but they subsequently declassified the whole thing. And he was asked specifically, is this an official history of Salt War negotiations? And what role would you play in it? What sort of access was Mr. Newhouse given to official classified documents? Who reviewed the manuscript and commented on the manuscript and this sort of thing? And what came out was, you never got a clear idea of whose initiative it was. Did Kissinger ask him to do it? Did he ask Kissinger if he could do it? Did he start on it and get involved with Kissinger? Kissinger then open all the records to him. But it's quite clear that the thing was written with the fullest cooperation from Kissinger and with access to all of the classified records of in the hands of the NSC staff that pertained to the subject, except for limited distribution back channel message tracking. And that when Newhouse was finished, that the book was reviewed. I forget who did it. It was a member of Kissinger's NSC staff who was directed by Kissinger to review and comment on the thing from the object of correcting any factual errors.
And it was the object of correcting factual errors or just security stuff?
No, it wasn't security. It was correcting factual errors.
Was it?
Yeah, and Kissinger was quite clear on that point in his testimony. And
I might hear what Newhouse said about that, because I don't think standard, you know, people say different things about things like that. And I have some journalism experience, and I know that. Correcting factual errors is legitimate, however. Yeah. It's a legitimate... as long as it isn't changing opinions, points of view, conclusions, or eliminating true things that reflect poorly on them. It's quite clear, I mean, the internal evidence of the book is that you wouldn't need the testimony to know that Kissinger had given Newhouse access to endless things. How else would he get them?
Sure.
So, in that point.
Paul Netzer, who read the book with great interest.
It's a well-written book.
Yeah,
it's a good book.
Made the observation that the book, as far as it went, was generally accurate, but that it was only a partial telling of the story. And because it was only a partial telling, the story comes through in a distorted way.
Huh.
And that specifically the positions and some actions taken by the JCS and by OSD and by the JCS and OSD members of the negotiating team are not referred to at critical points in the telling of the story, where their omission really results in a serious imbalance in the account.
Okay.
The other criticism which I would make, and Paul Nitzer is, first of all, as good a position to know in detail what was going on in Salt Lake as anybody.
And he was there.
And secondly, he's just a terribly honest guy, and he wouldn't say something like that unless it were true. And Nietzsche doesn't come through badly in the book himself. No, he has no personal reason.
Nor does Wolfstetter. Wolfstetter comes through fine. I mean, you know, there isn't any visible bad derogation of people whose positions might have been different.
The criticism I would make of the book is that with regard to strategic philosophy and understanding of some of the technical aspects of strategic forces and assault issues, on which there are disagreements within the government, the approach which Neuhaus takes, you know, when he's not presenting, he's saying this is the argument of so-and-so, where he's just explaining certain things for the benefit of the lay reader, the way they come out almost uniformly is the way that Kissinger would explain them, rather than the way that a military guy would explain them, or Paul Mitzel would explain them, or Jim Schlesinger would explain them, or Albert Wolfskill.
I think it's indisputable that the book also shows a certain amount, not an excessive amount, but a certain amount of either bias against the military or just the assumption that the military is always acting parochially in defense of its own budgets and own interests. I think that's there, too.
Yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing, you know, just in rebuttal to that whole philosophy, which I recognize you're not saying you share that philosophy.
I would tend to believe it, though, until it was proven.
Proven otherwise. Yeah. One of the little ironies in the whole lineup of salt positions in Rock City for the last couple of years is while Kissinger has opposed our going forward to the Russians with any proposals which call for mutual reductions on both sides in strategic systems, the Secretary of Defense and the JCS have endorsed specific negotiating positions which call for such reductions.
Call for mutual reductions.
Yeah. Now, the other prominent guy around town who's done it, of course, is Jackson, who has made several speeches in the last year, hammering very hard on this reductions theme and saying, you know, we want not only arms control, we want disarmament. You're never going to get to disarmament in the strategic area unless you get on the path of reductions phase by phase. But if you were to go to...
This is reductions in the strategic field you're talking about?
If you were to go to the average well-informed guy and say, you know, this issue of reductions, who do you think the government's for and who's against it, you'd get exactly the opposite position.
Yeah. I should think the strategic thing, you know, just thinking about it superficially, I should think the strategic thing would make everybody uncomfortable. The less of that they have to have, the better off everybody would be. It's such a volatile bunch of stuff, and it's so irrevocable once you use it. And, I shouldn't think any sane person would like to be in charge of 1,000 nuclear warheads, you know? Who wants that kind of thing on your back?
You know, I told you I was in oil fields about how they robbed the money that's available.
Yeah, but quite outside of that.
Yeah. I mean, oh, yeah. Sure. It makes it a dangerous world to live in.
It's also a personal responsibility that is more than any person should have to bear, I should think. I don't know. Maybe generals and admirals don't think that way, but they ought to if they don't.
Yeah. Kissinger's reason for being against them is he doesn't think they're emotional.
Well, I would have thought that was really... You'll get nowhere with that, because he's getting nowhere with anything right now.
The Russians just...
Is SALT II still just a big yawn for the Russians? Have any negotiations taken place yet in SALT II?
No seriously.
At least in the front.
No serious negotiations. And then, you know, for the last year now, the whole focus has been on the MIRV issue.
Yeah.
With the idea of getting a separate agreement that does nothing but control MIRVs.
Is that what they talked about in Moscow?
Yeah, that's what they talked about in Moscow. And this is where Kissinger has really been pitted against the Pentagon on this issue of a separate.
Pentagon just doesn't want a separate MIRV
agreement. Doesn't want a separate MIRV agreement. They reject
civilians and military are as one about
that. No difference between Schlesinger and the chiefs on that issue.
Schlesinger is fighting Kissinger on that.
Well...
Yes,
but...
Adversary.
Yeah, yes, with some qualifications. But anyway, Kissinger, a year ago, started saying, well, this MIR thing, we've really got to get on. Technology is running wild. The arms race is just getting completely out of control. The Russians are going to have just thousands of warheads. Some people are using aircraft by data and estimating the Russians, if they heard the whole missile throwaway, can have as many as 25,000 warheads.
And the number of warheads, you can get 14 at least on one of those things.
Yeah, on the SS-9, the SS-18, which is the MIR version of the SS-9, the follow-on to the SS-9. Anyway, Kissinger became totally preoccupied with the MIR. He said, we've got to go after that because the Russians are on conversion deployment. We've got to catch them before they have their whole force. The Pentagon said in reply to that, look, you know, it's 1973, 1974 now. The Russians aren't going to have their force merged until the end of this decade. It's not going to happen tomorrow or a year from now. So let's stay on the track toward a comprehensive, permanent agreement and not go down this side road that you want to take us down. They said, beyond that...
Why is it a side road?
It's a side road for this reason, that we had had great difficulty getting the Russians interested in negotiating. This led people to the conclusion that the leverage we were using to try to induce them to negotiate a comprehensive agreement seriously was not very great. And that may have been for a number of reasons. Zumwalt's argument was that we were simply not using all the leverage that we had available to us. That we were keeping the SALT negotiations within the very narrow confines of arms control negotiations, and we're not using Kissinger's famous theory of linkage to connect them with other bilateral issues. And Zumwalt's argument was we should go to the Russians and make clear to them that what is really at stake here is détente, and that détente cannot survive over the long run in a situation of serious imbalance in the strategic capabilities of the two sides. Uh-huh. That if the Russians are serious about wanting a relaxation of tensions, it will have some permanence to it. They've got to recognize that that has to rest on a foundation of military balance between the two countries.
Indeed. Newhouse implies that he doesn't actually say that one factor in suddenly loosening up the Russians was Kissinger's sudden unheralded appearance in Peking.
Okay. The captain's lessons out, by the way, Big Barry and Mike reports out.
Oh, good. Have we got a copy of it?
Or no,
you get it by phone?
I got it by phone just as when you heard this by phone.
Yeah. I suppose it's linkage. Kissinger indeed used linkage in getting the Russians to sit down and talk in the first talk, just for better or worse. Yeah, I see. Well, that is, Zumwalt pressed that point anyway. Huh?
Yep.
Was this also a Nitzer point?
Yeah.
This point get worked on in your sub-panel?
Yeah.
This was all part of...
Yeah. And this is the point at which...
When did he start pressing this one? And where did he press it?
Is it all?
Yeah.
Well, he started it in discussions with the other chiefs. He followed it up in memoranda that he sent to the chairman, and subsequently in some memoranda that he sent to the Secretary of Defense. During the last year he was CNO, he was more active than at any other time in the SALT area. And in addition to sending memoranda expressing viewpoints on a whole variety of SALT-related issues and suggesting what the general thrust of our negotiating position should be. He submitted a whole series of what are called CNOMs, C-N-O-M, C-N-O-Ms, which stands for C-N-O Memoranda,
yeah,
to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, you know, a CNOM and their counterparts, there's different acronyms for the Chiefs of Staff of the Air Force and the Army, CSAMs and CSAFs, are a vehicle for initiating an expression of JCS viewpoint on a particular subject. JCS can take a formal recorded position either by, as a result of their giving direction to the Joint Staff to prepare a position for them, the Joint Staff responding to stimulus that comes from outside the services, or by a service chief, in most cases, sending down a CNOM, which is a draft of a proposed JCS position. It gets circulated to the other services, they comment on it, the action officers meet, they revise language, goes through all of the drafting procedures that any JCS paper goes through. Finally comes up through us, the operational deputies and the three-star deputies and the chiefs, and they work a little more, and eventually goes up to the chiefs themselves. And they revise as necessary, and then it becomes a JCS position. Well, Zumwalt submitted a large number of CNOMs on solid issues, which eventually, sometimes in unrecognizable form, other times in almost the same language that they originally submitted, became JCS positions. And Zumwalt thought,
were those basically drafted forms at first over here?
Yeah. Zumwalt, you know, usually with some fairly specific indication from him of what he wanted him to say.
Oh, yeah, I know. I understand
the drafting process.
And
you just don't go draft something mostly for somebody and say, here, sign this, obviously. You have to have some indication he wants something to sign, right?
Right. So Zumwalt felt that one of the problems in SALT I had been that the chiefs never really thought through their positions very carefully, and they did not build a record by getting their positions reflected in formal, recorded memoranda
in
of the chiefs. Yes.
In terms of rigor of analysis and doing good homework and all that kind of stuff, how does the military compare to the civilian establishment?
In the SALT area?
Anywhere. Well, I suppose the military's better at some things.
Oh, yeah. I think they do quite well nowadays, primarily as a result of the impetus, that sort of thing, that was provided by McNamara, where the services were told that, you know, we don't give a damn about military judgment off the top of the head. You've been wearing the uniform for 30 years, but so what? You've got to be able to articulate it and defend it in terms that make sense to us. And so the services took that to heart. They trained a bunch of officers who have that capability. You know, they do it quite well.
They do it pretty well. Yeah. McNamara was good for the services.
It was good for the services. So, you know, it had a spillover effect. It wasn't limited to the systems analysis area in the narrow sense of that term, but it made the services much more aware generally that they had to be able to articulate and defend their positions on any issue in very sound, logical terms.
So at this point, a JCS paper on something will compare evenly with a State Department paper?
No, because now when you apply the label JCS to it, if you're talking about a service paper, Navy paper, Army paper, Air Force paper, that's one thing. If you say JCS, then it gets back into this business again, and compromises in language, and it results sometimes in absolutely incomprehensible style.
So JCS doesn't carry the weight it should in the general security councils. I mean, the work is not as good.
Well, I'm talking about, you know, there you are.
I'm just wondering whether to agree with that observation completely or to qualify it, and I think that I will agree with it, but at the same time I will say that the But what comes out of the NSC staff and what comes out of the, what's now called PA&E, Program Analysis and Evaluation, which is the new name for the Systems Analysis Group in OSD, is not all that good either from the point of view of quality nowadays. I think it's declined in the last several years.
Yeah.
So on a comparative basis, JCS may not be all that bad. But anyway, the CNOMS force the JCS to address in formal recorded fashion a lot of these SALT issues with the objective, on Zumwalt's part, of building a written record which would have two results. One, it would force Kissinger to take account of the JCS views by, you know, confronting him with a piece of paper that says, here's what we think about this issue. And Kissinger would not then later be able to present, you know, retrospectively present.
Well, this, in effect, answers what I was asking before, which was, wasn't the ease with which Kissinger at first was able to brush off the military views here, partly because the military itself did not work of the very best quality.
It wasn't a question of quality. It was a question of the military acting in an aggressive way to ensure that their views were presented at all. And given the fact that the committee mechanisms of the NSC system had really ceased to function as a medium for presentation of adversary views and working out of consensus, this presentation of JCS memoranda that recorded their views for the historical record, and for such influences they might have on Kissinger as he went down the road toward an agreement, became particularly important. And Zumwalt felt that at the time of SALT I, the chiefs were in a weakened position because they could not demonstrate clearly what their positions and arguments had been leading up to the agreements. And therefore, Kissinger was able to portray the situation as one in which the rest of the government, he carried the rest of the government along with him up to the point of negotiating the agreements. Mm-hmm. When, as a matter of fact, this really wasn't the case, but it couldn't be documented as not having been the case. So,
of course, the fact that you had a secretary at that point who, as you say, was fairly disinterested in the details contributed to that.
But anyway, the chiefs, and SALT II, thanks mainly to the pressure Zumwalt kept on them, built a very impressive record of positions. And this didn't, you know, just how impressive it was didn't strike me fully, and I don't think it even struck Zumwalt fully, until we went up to the Hill to testify before the Jackson Committee. And Jackson asked Moore to outline the history of the SALT II negotiations up to that point and to indicate what the JCS position had been as negotiations progressed on all of the key issues. And Moore had in front of him, you know, a notebook with about 14 key JCS memoranda. Which he was able to use to summarize the whole SALT II process and to indicate with great clarity what the JCS position had been on each one of these issues as time went on. No other agency of government has clearly recorded the history of their views on SALT II as the JCS.
That kind of fouls up the back channel a little bit, too, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Quite as easy to go waltzing off on by yourself when there's that kind of documentation.
Yeah.
Kissinger must be pretty annoyed with from Wall and Company at this point.
He didn't realize until fairly late what a formidable adversary Jamal was in the Salt area. I don't think he realized. Since a lot of what Jamal was doing was within the confines of the executive sessions of JCS, particularly in the initial months of Salt. There weren't too many people who knew what kind of influence he was wielding there.
Well, if Kissinger had realized it earlier, it is safe to assume he'd have spent some time buttering him up.
Yeah, I think so.
Or else made sure he got fired, one or the other.
Yeah, it would be difficult to, as the chiefs have got statutory, 4-year statutory terms.
Do you have to be fired for cause or something? Do you have to relieve? Have to be? I suppose it's never come up, has it?
It's never come up that I can recall. And, you know, the chiefs used to be appointed for 2-year terms.
Yeah.
Then Admiral Anderson was fired by McNamara.
Yeah.
And this was one of the reasons that the Congress enacted the mandatory 4-year term for services without possibility of reappointment.
Had they but known. Yeah, Anderson is going to turn out to be one of the villains of the book. We're all glad he got fired.
Yeah, I think that's quite clear. We're going to have to quit here.
Yeah, I imagine
pretty soon. Let me just mention one more thing that'll be of interest to you. Right toward the end of the last month of his tenure as CNO, Jamal was really very concerned about the direction in which Salt was going. And, you know, I'm leaping over a lot of history now, but I mentioned Kissinger seemed absolutely determined to get a MIRV agreement. I didn't finish telling you why the chiefs and SecDef thought a separate MIRV agreement was a bad idea. But they did, and Kissinger didn't seem responsive to any of this criticism or argumentation at all. And Kissinger, in a couple of VP meetings as we got closer to the summit, made quite clear the fact, you know, he earlier had advanced a lot of fairly technical rationales for summit. As the stress here and the chiefs one by one shot down those arguments and pointed out that they really didn't hold water, Kissinger would abandon them, although interestingly enough, he still uses a lot of them publicly. But within the bureaucracy, he dropped these things. And it finally came down to one argument, that the Tant was in very serious trouble as a result of the Mideast War, as a result of the administration's inability to deliver on the trade bill because Jackson was blocking it on the North Korean nation and the Jewish immigration issue. And as a consequence, the advocates of the time within the Soviet Union were in serious trouble with their political adversaries. And that what we needed in order to keep the Tant alive in both this country and in the Soviet Union, and to convince people in both countries it was a good thing, there was something good in détente for everybody, was to show that it could produce a follow-on agreement in the Salt area, which was kind of the centerpiece of the whole détente relationship. And for the benefit of Brezhnev, show that agreement would be one which he could represent as, if not advantageous to the Soviet Union, at least not disadvantageous to the Soviet Union in the terms that the Soviets saw the situation, which were quite different from the terms in which we saw the situation. And it was very clear toward the end there that that was the principal justification that he saw for Salt. And he was verbal agreement that he was prepared to pay a rather large price in terms of accommodating to the Soviet viewpoints. Now, he went to Moscow, you recall, in March, a couple of months before the summit.
Right.
And they talked the MIRV agreement at that time. They talked specific numbers. And the Russians' initial position was that we should have an equal number of MIRV missiles on both sides. 1,000 MIRV missiles plus 1,000 MIRV missiles for the Russians. These are ICBMs with no limits for either side on SLBMs. Well, even Kissinger recognized that this was such a bad deal that we couldn't accept it, because 1,000 MIRV missiles on both sides meant that with their superiority in throw weight, that would translate into many more warheads for them. On top of that, there was a great feeling here that if the Russians got that kind of a MIRV deal, they would regard the whole strategic arms control subject as finished. You know, we've taken care of the numbers issue now in the interim agreement. We've taken care of the MIRV issue in this agreement. What more is there to negotiate?
The
and they would, they would just say, insist on maintaining that status quo in perpetuity. And even though the interim agreement had a limited life and would expire in 1977, when 77 came, we would be in a very weak position to negotiate any adjustment in those numbers from the Russians.
As a Sovietologist, do you have an impression that this, the effrontery of that proposal might have partly been due to their sense that Nixon was so shaky that he might settle for almost anything?
Well, I think so. I think the Russians looked at it this way, that they didn't much care whether they got an agreement with us or not. That they were interested for the next several years in going ahead with their planned MIRV deployments anyway.
Yeah, right.
That Nixon was in a weak position. We were the proposers in this case. We were the ones who were anxious to get an agreement.
Yeah.
So why not try out something absolutely preposterous? You know, if we accept it, nothing lost for the Russians. They come out a little better than they would have otherwise.
Yeah. Right.
And that was the philosophy in which they operated.
But they probably wouldn't have even made such a proposal to a president they saw as in a strong position.
I think that's the case. Anyway, Kissinger told Russians about Moscow.
Watergate did have a very pronounced effect on everything.
Sure it did.
I think it also, if I may venture a speculation, which I would be glad to hear your comment on, I think it might have also had a pronounced effect on the relationship between the military and the White House, simply because, on the whole, generals and admirals at the top, anyway, tend to be straight arrows and get to be pretty appalled by such goings on.
Yeah.
Is that a valid speculation?
Oh, yeah, that's very accurate. And, you know, there was indeed a lot of feeling among the
commander-in-chief shouldn't be a crook kind of thing.
That's right. Yeah, and, you know, just general disgust for the whole sordid shabbiness.
Because it does seem to me that, particularly since McNamara was wielding the whip, the military has tended to be a little deferential to the civilians and keep a low profile and so forth.
Yeah.
But evidently in the last half a year, they've emerged from their shell a little bit. Or is that wrong? I don't know what they're doing with Ford.
I don't know whether that's. You mean as a result of Watergate?
Well, I mean partly as a result of Watergate, perhaps. I think Kissinger, as a newspaper reader, I think Kissinger had the military intimidated and swaddled for a long time. And that he doesn't anymore.
That's very true. Yeah. But of course, this is in part a function of the fact that Kissinger's prestige and authority generally has been diminished in the last 6 months or so.
But Watergate has contributed to that Watergate diminution.
Yeah, the wiretap episode that he got involved in. You saw
the charge based or baseless that he was gonna make a bad deal with the Russians to save the administration.
Yeah. And the whole thing he got tangled up with Jackson on the secret agreement where the two of them were exchanging charges publicly. And Jackson, in essence, was saying to Kissinger, "You're lying."
And indeed, the threat to resign if you don't
threat
stop.
Threat to resign, yeah. That's the most
that helped him a hell of a lot.
Press conference. And you saw a very marked change in the attitude of the press toward Kissinger beginning about 8 months ago. When, for the first time, critical articles about him began to appear with some frequency.
Yeah.
And you had Ted Schultz did this piece about how he negotiated the Vietnam settlement, which he had raised some serious questions about going down there. Yeah. A lot of the Jewish community in this country was turned against him by their perception that he was really willing to sell Israel down the river if necessary in order to make the Arabs happy and to avoid tensions with the Russians in that part.